Fellow members, we are going now to continue our study of the processes of the emanation and formation of universes, and I shall take it up from the point which we had previously reached. Perhaps you'll allow me to go back, however, to one or two of the first principles, pick up the threads, and then deal with the subject of the Logos, or the creative word, in rather more detail, though within the great limitations of my knowledge. Then, as we progress, we will study the work of the hierarchies of the angels, who are particularly concerned with the building of form. And in this study we will include the life and play or work of the nature spirits themselves. This, I hope, will prove interesting, for it will lead us to a consideration of the wonderful dance of creation, which the nature spirits continually perform, dancing all unconsciously to themselves, to the great symphony of creation, which the divine musician ever conceives and ever performs throughout creative day. Well, we are taught in theosophy that when cosmic night draws to a close, the processes of emanation and form building are initiated, maintained, and directed by a great intelligence. And since the energy used is of the order of sound, this great and inconceivably wonderful being is called the Logos, sometimes the ever-uttered Word. Of course, we should not think in any way of a human voice, should we, or of a man speaking, but rather of the sending forth from a spiritual source of a form-producing energy of the order or quality of sound. Thus, the emitted great breath, as it is called, is breathed out by the Supreme Deity, and this emitted breath brings all things into existence. Then, as we've already seen, at the close of a period of activity or day, he breathes in, drawing all things back into that source whence they came. By the by, I noticed that I used the masculine personal pronoun then, didn't I? Saying that at the close of a period of activity, he, the Logos, breathes in, drawing all things back into that source whence they came. We students of theosophy must most carefully avoid any anthropomorphism, which means thinking of deity in terms of man, and particularly of the human form and functions. Neither, of course, has the supreme deity to be thought of as being either masculine or feminine. He includes all possible polarities and potencies in one vast and splendid unity. Nevertheless, for convenience, shall I continue to use the masculine personal pronoun, asking you to remember, if and when I do so, that it is for convenience only. Thus, this out-breathing and in-breathing of the breath of God, the breath of life, or the breath of heaven, is perpetual if alternating, but having no conceivable ultimate beginning and no imaginable ultimate end. Now, when the great breath is thus breathed out, harmoniously sounding forth the creative idea, in terms of celestial music, perhaps, that sounding forth sets up vibrations in primordial substance, in space, sometimes called the great deep. Under the impact of the singing breath of God, space itself becomes soniferous and is then called the akasa, a word and idea in Sanskrit which you may have come across in your studies. Akasa, the soniferous ether, or soul of the ether. Another subject. This sound-charged substance, in its turn, is capable of emitting audible energies, and these relayed or echoed in the lower worlds, mental, astral, and physical, produce the shapes of nature, all of them according to the divine thought or idea. So you see, the emitted creative agency is the breath of God, and it is of the order of sound. In Hinduism, it is called the Vach, in Sanskrit, V-A-C-H, the voice, the creative power of the active, manifested Brahma, the Logos or Word. Vach, the voice, then, is God at work, and behind God at work is God the conceiving power, God the illimitable source of the creative logos or outpoured word. Very mysterious, isn't it? Very abstract, but fascinating, don't you find? Let us follow it on a little further. See if we can find out what is the nature of this so-called word. Let us try and discover meditatively something about it. Well, surely it must be at least dual, having a soul or inner essence and vibrating energy or body. The soul is the divine thought, and the body is the vibration of sound. Of course, that is true of every word, isn't it? Whenever we speak, there is a duality. The thought expressed and the aerial soniferous vibrations, as it were, soul and body. Presumably the same sort of thing happens on a universal scale, when the Logos, as divine musician, similarly conceives and chants his glorious song. Remember what I said about the personal pronoun? Conceives and chants his glorious song. He begins this, you will remember, at the dawn of creation. For we have seen that solar systems, in obedience to universal cyclic law, emerge, then pass into obscuration, and re-emerge perpetually. Each new emanation, it is taught, continues the evolutionary process from the stage attained at the close of the preceding era, and these periods of obscuration and manifestation are called in cosmogony night and day respectively, or in Sanskrit, as we've seen, Pralaya, night, and Manvantara, day. Eventually then, day, or the period of manifestation, does draw to a close and evening draws nigh. Then the life and the light within the form begin to be withdrawn. The voice grows softer, more remote, affecting only the higher spiritual worlds, until at last all is withdrawn back into darkness and night. Then, when once more there is light and day, the Logos again speaks, and by the power of his word brings all things into being, initiates a new cycle of manifestation, a new forthgoing and return. So the Logos can be partly pictured as thought sound and named as voice, a voice, if you like, which sounds forth the first expression or the motive of the new universe to be. This motive will contain within itself all the products of the preceding universes up to the last moment of the pre-solar system. But to it, the new or freshly emanated Logos will add the divine thought of all that is to be produced in its successor. Now let us follow the process still further. The voice, as the first expression of this motive of the universe, is heard, symbolically, or responded to, perhaps I'd better say, by virgin matter. And gradually, the planes of nature, with their forms and inhabitants, begin to appear. Into these forms, the Logos pours forth perpetually his life, that they may live. And this perpetual outpouring is spoken of as his continuous sacrifice, his everlasting oblation, his eternal surrender of his life upon the cross of matter with its four directions of space. This is the cosmic crucifixion, as it were. Thus, matter vivified, forms produced, the monads then begin the projection of their rays into the prepared universe, and the unfoldment of their latent power is begun again and continues till the end of the period of manifestation. But we're rather concerned with the universe of form in these studies together of the creative process. Excuse the constant repetitions. They're deliberate because we are dealing with metaphysical and rather difficult subjects. So we see that the universal word, when uttered, becomes manifest as myriads of chords, each chord a coherent, self-existent sound, which has both its force and its light manifestation. Yes, not only can the word be heard with the spiritual ear, so to say, but it also can be seen as light by the spiritual eye and felt as force. Thus observed, each chord appears as a relatively changeless, abstract form, if such a thing can be conceived, an archetype, a divine idea, and this is established, as far as I know, at the causal level of each of the planets. So, if we were to look into the arupa, or formless worlds, somewhere we would see the divine thought established as a wondrous form which contained within itself, archetypally, so to speak, germinally, embryonically, the seed idea of all that is ever going to be produced. These archetypes, in their turn, sound their words, relaying the original primal word force down, diagrammatically only, of course, relaying the original primal word force down into the worlds of form. That means the lower mental, the astral, the etheric, and eventually where the physical worlds appear, the whole wonderful, densest garment of God, as it's called, physical nature herself. Now we're beginning to get a better understanding, perhaps, of what we mean by a cosmic archetype, model, motif, using the musical term. This divine archetype is not to be thought of as a static model, which is going to be copied by the form-building angels and nature spirits, as we'll see a little later on. On the contrary, the archetype is itself a dynamic focus of the original word force, and it is echoing or resounding, relaying into these denser worlds that same form-producing energy as sound. In consequence, magnetic fields are set up in the mental, astral, etheric matter. Substance is drawn into these magnetic fields, and with the aid of the building orders of the gods and the nature spirits at the physical level, this matter is molded into living forms. These forms, vivified by the outpoured divine life, become, as I've just said, the abode of intelligences at different stages of evolution. The monads, as we call them, at the mineral, plant, animal, human, superhuman, and angelic phases of the one divine manifestation. As a result of experience in forms, these unfolding intelligences, assisted also by another order of the gods, which I call the Awakeners, gradually unfold their innate faculties and powers until the degree of development set for them, and for the form, of course, has been attained. Thus the gods, the angelic hosts, may be conceived of as both builders of form and assistant stimulators of the process of the evolution of consciousness. That, in part, I think, describes one of the functions and activities of those two orders of the angelic hosts, the form builders and the awakeners, as I have named them in my studies and writing. Of course, when the great word power imbued with divine thought is uttered, archetypes appear, and through them there is relayed the same thought-charged sound, the first forms which are naturally produced are crude. Matter, especially in the etheric and physical worlds, responds to the formative energy very slowly, for it possesses the quality of inertia, doesn't it? And it resists the spiritual formative power sound. In consequence, you have the crudity of the primitive in all things. However, the gods are ceaselessly at work, and the great craftsman himself ever utters his formative word. And these two powers together gradually perfect, polish, beautify the evolving forms until they come nearer and nearer to the pattern in the mount, as it is said, the divine idea, the archetype conceived and held in the wondrous mind of God. Then, as I have stated previously, and I hope you'll excuse constant repetitions, we're studying together, aren't we? And I don't regard these talks as lectures to be perfect in form, but just a sharing of ideas. And so I repeat, when the standard of relative perfection has been reached by all beings, and in obedience to the law of cycles, the time limit of manifestation has come, then the whole solar system is withdrawn into a crystallized, subjective state in which it stays until the reawakening occurs. As Omar Khayyam is said to have written, and I quoted him, I believe, in an earlier talk, without perhaps really knowing what he was saying in the Rubaiyat, which is very mystical, you know. He wrote, perhaps referring to this very period, the stars are setting, and lo, the phantom caravan reaches that no thing it set out from. No objective thing, of course, is meant. And thus, all the fruitage, all the beings and things of the preceding creative epoch remain in this frozen or crystallized condition until, under the same cyclic law, it all reappears and the process of development or ascent is continued from the point reached at the close of the preceding period of objective manifestation. Isn't that a magnificent and wondrous idea which Theosophy presents to those who are prepared really to study its teachings? For this magnificent concept of an everlasting, eternal ascent and continuing progression to ever higher and higher states is indeed one of the marvelous teachings that Theosophy presents to its students. You remember that in the first of the three great truths taught in Theosophical literature, we read of them in the ideal of the White Lotus, don't we? The first truth tells that the future of the soul of man, for example, is the future of a thing whose growth and splendor are without limit, and that all that splendor and glory of nature and of man is there, inherent from the beginning. The alternation of night and day brings forth into successive objective expressions in ever greater beauty and glory that which has always existed in the monad. And occult philosophy sees this process as continuing indefinitely, there being no limit to the evolutionary possibilities. Such, as I understand it at any rate, is one of the teachings of Theosophy. Now we come to an expression of personal views, and I recognize that when an abstract idea, which is a continuing process, an ever-flowing force or design, is defined by a limited, finite mind, then error, or at least limitation, can come in. Please remember, therefore, that from now on, as I am dealing with a subject which has interested me greatly and about which I've written a good deal, when I deal with the Kingdom of the Gods, to name one of my books, it will be merely as a fellow student sharing undogmatically and without the slightest authority certain growing ideas. One who has tried to pierce the veil of nature's garb gradually begins to see some of the mysteries of life, and he can, if he wishes, study the mysterious laws and processes by which life becomes expressed in form. For I have, almost as soon as I heard about it in this life, nearly 50 years ago now, sought to hear the creative word, and if it could be, to watch and describe the hierarchies of the orders of the building angels at work, and even to see the little nature spirits in their dance and play, all of which I ultimately found to be expressive of the creative word. I think one of the very first experiences I had in this endeavor, really to pierce the veil of nature's outer garb, was a sense of rhythmic dancing movement, first of all, sometimes of spherical forms, spheres of light, which when more carefully studied, turned out to have assumed the various forms of the classical types of the nature spirits, the gnomes, the brownies, and the salamanders of fire, the sylphs and fairies of air, and the beautiful undines of water. Doubtless you know I've written quite a bit about them, trying to draw people into this wonderland of beauty, but as I believe also of truth, in which these inner lives and forces of nature are at work. Well now, if you'll remember that this is purely personal for a time now, at their source, these energies of the word are of tremendous potency, and from one point of view, as far as I can ascertain, the whole race of the gods serve somewhat as electrical transformers. Took me a long time to find that out, you know, but I gradually began to see that the archangels step down the voltage of the outward creative word force, from the solar archangels to the planetary angels. All of them serve somewhat as angelic rheostats or resistances, stepping down the mighty creative power. They appear to receive into themselves the primordial creative thought word force, and as if by resistance to its flow, to reduce its voltage, slow it down, as it were. Indeed, studying it further, it seems to me that all manifestation involves the slowing down of energy, just as human action and speech involve a slowing down of thought. From the solar gods, then, the word force passes through their lesser brethren, rank upon rank, until it reaches the physical worlds. There, with the assistance of the nature spirits, the word throws matter into shapes as conceived by the creative mind. The order of the gods who thus assist the Logos in this process of the production of evolving, improving forms by the utterance of the word, I have called for myself in my studies, as you've heard, the builders. The members of the higher ranks of this order would seem to correspond to those devas who in Hinduism are called Gandharvas. Now, the Gandharvas are referred to as the angels of music, the gods of song, and they are aware of the motive of the great symphony of creation. They know, intuitionally doubtless, the divine intent. They are aware of the archetype. They hear the divine song, direct and re-echo it, rank upon rank through their hierarchies, until it is brought right down to a voltage and a potency where it will build instead of destroy, as it might do in its naked potency. That is the kind of idea that eventually dawned upon me as I endeavor to study these great beings and their work. Now, how do the greater and lesser gods perform that function? How do they work? I offer a suggestion. They work by unifying themselves with the descending or out poured word force. They do this more particularly, each of the orders, with such streams of power as are vibrating at frequencies identical with those of their own nature. They amplify and augment the form-producing power. And so, by the time the divine energy reaches the lower worlds, it has had its capacity to produce forms augmented, though the inner force is stepped down accordingly so that it will build rather than destroy. It thus impinges upon the mental, astral, and etheric worlds and causes the molecular combinations and crystalline formations to appear and to grow into the forms of the physical world.